Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. So here's what we'll do. Some telecommunications policy, a little bit of taxpayer dollars paying for harassment claims in Congress, and we'll end with Indian food. Sound all right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, November 21. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a definition followed by a news update in service of a wider story. The definition is of net neutrality, the idea that all the data going back and forth online ought to be treated equally, that the companies that control the pipes, as it were, can't slow down or charge different rates for different kinds of data. That's important today, and here comes the news update, because this afternoon, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai said he is going to ask the commission, which is split along party lines, you need to know, 3-2 in favor of the GOP, to get rid of Obama-era rules requiring the net to be neutral, and then to adopt a more free market approach to the internet. The wider story is that there is a whole lot going on in telecommunications right now, not all of it completely clear of purpose. Ryan Knutson covers telecommunications for the Wall Street Journal. Ryan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We should say right at the outset that Chairman Pai has been signaling that this was coming for a good long while now, right?
Yeah, he's been at the FCC for several years as a commissioner, and he was very opposed to net neutrality then. So it's certainly no surprise that once he became chairman, he made it a priority to eliminate these rules.
What do you make then of what seems to be some policy inconsistencies between a lot of the things that are happening in telecommunications right now? I'm thinking specifically of AT&T and Time Warner. The Department of Justice has said they're not interested in letting that merger go forward, putting some governmental influence in there. And then Chairman Pai saying, you know what, we're going to get the government out of regulating the internet. How do you make sense of that?
Well, the new antitrust chief at the Justice Department gave a really interesting speech last week where he outlined the new thinking at the department, which is that the government should be small and it shouldn't regulate very much. But in order to achieve that, it should have an aggressive antitrust policy. So these things might not actually seem like they go together. But his argument was that you don't need regulations if you don't let companies get big and you let competition rule the marketplace. Most people would say that AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner is a classic vertical merger, and it's not something that people would, or that the antitrust law would normally support enforcing. So it's almost like taking it to a whole new realm of regulation. It's almost like regulating against vertical deals in the first place. So there's certainly some inconsistencies if you look at it like that.
Right. On that antitrust division chief at the Department of Justice, Makan Del Rahim is his name. He gave this speech back in October, right before the election, in which he said, after this deal was announced, you know what? It's going to get a lot of attention, but I'm not sure that there's a legitimate antitrust concern here. So clearly he's changed his mind.
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of, I mean, that public statement, as well as the statements that Trump has made throughout the campaign and previously against CNN, and also that he wanted to block it, are certainly going to feature prominently in the case. When AT&T had his press conference yesterday to announce that it was going to fight this, they played a recording of Del Rahim's comments from earlier. You know, obviously, you have to think about what his job was at the time. He was a lawyer working in the industry. So, you know, obviously lawyers want deals to happen because that gives them work. And then when you're a regulator, you know, you're sort of maybe you have a different set of forces at play that, you know, force you to think a certain way. One antitrust expert told me recently that never underestimate the power of politics when you're looking at policy or law.
Last time we had major telecommunications reform, though, and internet regulations was like 20 years ago, 1996 or something. And it's a completely different economy from then till now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really hard to predict where the future is going, which is part of the reason why the previous administration wanted these kinds of bright line rules. They wanted to say, look, the market should figure it out, but no company should, no internet provider should be able to block content. A lot of the companies were saying, look, Congress should pass a law that, you know, codifies the principles of net neutrality around, you know, no blocking and throttling and paid prioritization, but we don't want all these other rules. You know, the administration today went way beyond that and said, you know what? No rules altogether. We're going to step out of this game. And if there's any consumer harm that arises in the future, that's up to the Federal Trade Commission to try to police.
Ryan Knutson, he covers telecommunications at the Wall Street Journal. Ryan, thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
A correction now before we go on to our story on fracking and chemicals from last week. We told you about a man in Pennsylvania who thinks those chemicals, fracking chemicals, have poisoned his water. Our story said the state of Pennsylvania found the drilling company Chevron illegally dumped fracking water on his property. That's not the case. According to the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, it says the pollution violation had to do with rainwater, not fracking wastewater. On Wall Street today, up from the get-go and then up some more from there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. About 60,000 Haitians living in the United States are trying to figure out what is next. The Trump administration said today it is not going to renew what's known as temporary protected status for them, a provision that lets people already here because of war or natural disasters in their home countries stay and work legally. Citizens of 10 countries currently have what's known as TPS. Haitians are the second group this month, though, to get a heads up that their time is running out. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains that is unusual because that temporary status is often not quite so temporary.
Haitians lose their temporary protected status in July of 2019. Nicaraguans have until January that same year. And with El Salvador up for review in 2018, Royce Murray at the American Immigration Council doesn't like the numbers.
We're at risk of 300,000 people losing their immigration status in a short period of time.
This temporary status in the aftermath of a crisis can last decades, says immigration research consultant Jose Magana Salgado.
Under the Obama administration, generally we saw TPS designations be extended because of the conditions in these other countries. But under the Trump administration, we're seeing a substantially more stringent application of the TPS standard.
The Trump administration and others are calling for Congress to come up with a permanent solution. David Beer of the Cato Institute says that's because TPS is really just a patch on a broken immigration system.
We have these types of discretionary statuses to rectify the fact that we don't have really any legal means for people to travel for temporary periods to the United States for work.
Which is why, he says, a program that's meant to be a temporary fix in an emergency can end up being one of the few routes to legal status for thousands. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Round five of NAFTA negotiations, or renegotiations, wraps up today. And progress, it is fair to say, has been slow. One of the trickiest issues is something called rules of origin. Basically, what share of the parts of a product have to come from a NAFTA country to be able to cross borders tariff-free? Talks on cars, in particular, have been hard. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
U.S. negotiators want to increase demand for U.S. auto parts and the workers who make those parts, and make sure that mostly foreign cars aren't sneaking into the U.S. tariff-free through Mexico and Canada.
What do they say about the road to ruin paved by good intentions?
Emily Blanchard is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Currently, 62.5% of the parts in a car have to come from the U.S., Canada, or Mexico. The U.S. now reportedly wants to bump that up to 85% and have half of all parts come from the U.S. specifically. Problem is, Blanchard says these days automakers tend to have regional supply chains.
So instead of thinking of competition as American car companies and Canadian car companies and Japanese car companies and German car companies, think of it really as factory North America versus factory Europe versus factory Asia.
She says disrupting the NAFTA supply chain would make factory North America less competitive against factories Asia and Europe. Canada and Mexico don't like the U.S. proposal, nor do trade groups for U.S. auto and parts manufacturers. Jeffrey Schott with the Peterson Institute says if complying with these rules were too expensive, companies could just choose to pay a small tariff instead.
If you pay that tariff, you don't have to comply with any content rules. And so 0% of a car would have to be sourced in the United States for a car to qualify for the 2.5% tariff.
He says push too hard, you risk hurting the very workers you're trying to help. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan and the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives, is the latest politician to be accused of sexual misconduct. BuzzFeed reports Conyers settled a wrongful dismissal claim with a former employee who had said no to his advances. There was allegedly a payment involved as well. Conyers denies the whole thing, we got to say. Michelle Yeahy Lee is a political investigative reporter for The Washington Post. She has been covering both the process by which sexual harassment claims are made on Capitol Hill and also how the payment mechanism works. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what happens now if you accuse a member of Congress of some kind of sexual impropriety? What's the process?
You have to go through a multi-step process. There is an office called the Office of Compliance that handles these claims and helps facilitate the investigation. So first, you bring a claim to the Office of Compliance, and then you go through a 30-day, up to 30-day counseling period where you talk about your legal rights as an employee, you talk about your legal options, and then after that, you have to go through a 30-day mandatory mediation process, which is very different from the way it operates in the rest of the federal government, like in federal agencies or the executive branch, where you don't have to go through a mediation process. You can if you want, but you don't have to. And then after that, if you want to take it further, then you go through an administrative hearing or you take it to federal court. But a lot of the claims get settled during this mediation process.
So let's say you go through the process. There is a settlement, a monetary settlement of some kind arranged. Where does that money come from?
The money under the law is supposed to come from an account in the Treasury, in the U.S. Treasury. But what's interesting about the latest allegations against Representative Conyers from Michigan is that he seems to have settled, this is according to the reporting, he appears to have settled the claim and paid it out of his own member budget, which is not the formal process that exists. So it starts to bring attention to a different aspect of this process that we didn't quite know about until this reporting came out.
Yeah, a different pot of money. But the root source of all this money is taxpayer dollars, right? So how do I, as Joe taxpayer, find out whether this special treasury office has been paying out on whose behalf? And the same thing for members' budgets.
Joe taxpayer is not going to have much luck figuring that out because there's not much transparency to the system. The Office of Compliance has released figures that about $17 million have been paid out through this fund over the past 20 years. But we don't know exactly which claims were settled. All it tells us is the number of claims settled per year. So there's really no way to figure out any more about these settlements.
Right. But, well, somebody knows. They're just not telling, right?
Sure, right. We don't know.
Right.
You know.
There are reports that Speaker Ryan and Nancy Pelosi, they also were not aware of who's getting what and on whose behalf, too.
Right, which goes to the point about the lack of transparency in this system. You know, in Congress, each member's office basically operates as its own small business. They handle their own claims. They deal with their own employment issues on their own. And there is no central HR office in Congress. And that's the issue here, which is that there's no consistent process for employees to be able to get trained or know what their options are or a central place where members are held accountable to report what they've paid out in settlements.
Michelle Yeahy Lee, she is a political investigative reporter at The Washington Post. Michelle, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Coming up.
My mom doesn't believe that I actually wrote a cookbook.
He did, Mom. He did. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 160 today, 0.6%, 23,590. The NASDAQ up 71 points, about 1%, 6,862. The S&P 500 up 16, 0.6%, 25,99. Shake up at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise today. Meg Whitman, the CEO, is stepping down effective February the 1st. Company shares rose 0.2%. Today, the end of net neutrality, perhaps, means internet providers can charge us different rates for different content. Good news for companies that connect us to the web. Comcast up 1.6% today. Verizon ticked up a tiny bit, really flat though. People against net neutrality, content companies. Netflix up 1%. Facebook shares up 1.7%. Today you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Had you thought you were in for a break from tax bill news just because Congress is off for Thanksgiving week? Well, sorry, not sorry, because they are coming back next week to try to come to some kind of House-Senate agreement, and the housing industry is going to be watching closely. The two different bills, one in the House, one in the Senate, as you know, between them call for capping deductions for mortgage interest and property taxes, as well as eliminating the deductions for state and local income taxes entirely. Marketplace's Rima Kreis hit the open house circuit here in L.A. to see how brokers and would-be buyers are managing the housing uncertainty.
This is the kind of house that can break a new buyer's heart. A 1920s California bungalow with hardwood floors, vintage cabinets, lemon trees in the backyard. For today's open house, real estate broker Anselm Clenard has also turned on some jazz to set the mood.
Yeah, just set the mood. And also just to help me feel warm and ready to talk to people, you know?
Clenard will probably be talking to a lot of people. This little house is in one of L.A.'s hippest neighborhoods, and it's on the market for less than $800,000, well below what most houses go for around here. So odds are it won't be for sale for long. Dozens of people have already been through the door.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
My name's Anselm. Let me know if you have any questions while you're looking around.
Clenard is a pro at the standard questions, like when was it built? What are the schools in the neighborhood like? But these days, he says, people also want to know about the Republican tax plan.
I am getting questions from my client base about it already. Well, it's like, how is this going to affect me? That's what they want to know.
Under the tax bill passed by the House, homeowners would be allowed to deduct interest on no more than $500,000 of mortgage debt compared to $1 million today. The Senate plan doesn't touch mortgages, but it does call for scrapping state and local tax deductions, including property tax. Clenard lays it out for one would-be buyer as she inspects the kitchen cabinets across the room.
It's going to take away some of your deductible interest based on your mortgage amount.
So and you also don't want to be a homeowner anymore?
I'm not saying you don't want to be a homeowner. It's a very good question.
And the answer may depend on where you live.
This hits New York. This hits Los Angeles hard. It hits San Francisco hard.
That's Brad Keyes. He's also a real estate broker in L.A.
It doesn't hit most of the country as hard as it does, you know, higher valued real estate.
Keyes is showing me around a neighborhood in Los Angeles that's full of that higher valued real estate. Palm trees line the winding streets and tower over a mix of luxurious mid-century and Spanish homes.
But this house is probably a $1.2 million house. So is this one. This one's a very big house over here on that lot, which is about 20,000 square feet. It might be like 2.2.
Homebuyers in pricey neighborhoods like this are the most likely to be affected by changes to the tax code.
If you can't write off all of your mortgage and if you can't write off all your property tax, you know, that's a major disincentive.
A disincentive that will make Key's life harder since he uses the deductions as a selling point. But he says,
I think people are still going to buy homes. It's just not as attractive anymore.
Christopher Brown, a video editor, has been house shopping in L.A. for about a year now. When I meet him, he's with his wife checking out a three-bedroom house listed at nearly $1 million. Brown says when it comes to the mortgage interest deduction,
I tend not to use it in my budget in terms of what I can afford, but it's always like an icing on the cake that could lower the prices and help you own a home.
He says if the deduction were capped, it would effectively cost him an extra $4,000 a year. But he also thinks it could drive down home prices.
So we're kind of like standing still and watching because there's no point in buying if it's going to hurt the housing costs and if things are going to start coming down soon.
Brown hasn't been totally standing still. He's been calling House Speaker Paul Ryan, or at least he tried. He left a voicemail.
Yeah, I actually left two because the first time it cut me off. I ran out of time when I was leaving the message.
You just had a lot to say.
I had a lot to say. I'm very, I mean, it's going to make my life more expensive.
That's if House Republicans get their way. And we're still a long way from that. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Sometimes we talk about food on this program. Sometimes we talk about the entertainment industry. Today, a twofer. Sri Rao works in entertainment here, but also in Bollywood, India's giant movie economy. He's American-born of Indian descent. His latest project is a cookbook that pairs homemade Indian meals with Bollywood movies. Kind of plans the whole evening for you, really. It's called Bollywood Kitchen. Sri Rao, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are a writer. You've sold a thing to ABC, right?
Yes.
And now what? Cookbooks?
A natural transition, right?
That's right.
Well, I'm one of the few Americans who has worked in Bollywood in the world's largest film industry, and I love these films that I grew up watching. And so I wanted to introduce Americans to this great musical genre of films. And while I'm at it, cook them some really good home-cooked Indian food at the same time.
Let's talk about Bollywood for a second before we get into the food.
Yeah.
You have chosen in this book not the classics, but sort of modern-ish Bollywood, right?
Right.
Okay, so first of all, there's a difference. There's classic Bollywood and modern.
Mm-hmm.
Help me understand that.
Well, in the mid-90s, there was sort of a turning point in the Bollywood film industry, and that was when movies out of India became a lot more global in their appeal. They had higher production values. They had more sophisticated storytelling. They started telling stories in a way that appealed to audiences outside of India, particularly here in America and in the United Kingdom. And I sort of started my journey at that point and worked forward. So to show you what the new era of contemporary Bollywood cinema looks like.
You tell stories in this book, or a story in this book, about growing up in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Watching Bollywood films with your parents, your mom.
Yeah. So I'm from a small town in central Pennsylvania, and I was one of very few non-white kids in my community growing up. Every day after dinner, my parents would pop a tape into the VCR, and we would watch these fantastic Bollywood movies, and that's how I learned the language. That's how I learned about the music and the culture and so many of the traditions of where my parents came from.
So there you are, like a 10-year-old kid watching these movies and not really understanding it yet?
Yeah, with the subtitles, reading the subtitles, and then I fell in love with them because I'm a writer, and I've been writing scripts since I was 5 years old, so it immediately resonated for me. And through these films, I was transported to another place different from where I was growing up in this working class, primarily white town. And it meant a lot to me. And I think it means a lot to second generation Indian immigrants like myself, children who are born here. For us, Bollywood movies are the way that we learn about this place that our parents come from.
It's a thing in your generation and your age, really?
Mm-hmm. It very much is. And anyone who's ever been to an Indian wedding here in America knows that it's like 3 days straight of just Bollywood dancing and Indian food.
So let's talk about the book for a minute. But before we do that, I want to ask you about Indian cooking in this country.
Yeah.
Right? So I've spent a lot of time in China, and you go to China and you eat the Chinese food in China, mm-hmm. and it ain't the food that you get here. Same mm-hmm. deal with Indian?
Yes, it's very, very much true. The Indian food in America is now its own thing. And as people like me are starting to come of age now, you know, I'm one of the oldest American-born Indians in the country. You know, immigration from India was only legalized in 1965. At that time, in 1965, when immigration was opened up from India, there were only 10,000 Indians in the entire country. My dad being one of them.
Wow.
And now there are over 4 million, I believe, something like that. And so you're starting to see us as a group come up and sort of find our voice in various fields. So people like, you know, Mindy Kaling and Aziz Ansari in entertainment, or Kamala Harris and Nikki Haley in politics. And then in the world of food, you know, this is one of the first or one of few cookbooks that have been written by someone born in America who's of Indian descent.
When you have this conversation with your parents, I assume you talk about this stuff as you were doing this book. What do they say about that? What are their feelings?
My mom doesn't believe that I actually wrote a cookbook. and I didn't actually tell her for the first 6 months that I was working on it because I knew that she would just laugh at me, which is exactly what she did. She said to me, quote, what American is going to spend $25 to buy a book with your recipes in it?
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens after this interview. It's called Bollywood Kitchen by Sri Rao. Sri, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you, like me, need a Bollywood primer, Sri left one for us. It's Bollywood 101 at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that Dara Khosrowshahi has been the CEO of Uber for exactly 84 days, and clearly the good times, such as they've been, are now over. Bloomberg reports this afternoon that hackers stole the personal data of 57 million customers and drivers in October of last year. And it gets better, that the company paid the hackers $100,000 to delete the data and keep the breach quiet. You can't make this stuff up, folks. All right, we're done. The Dow up 160 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ put on 71 points, about 1%. S&P 500 up 16 points, 0.6%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.